6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Saudi Arabia has severed diplomatic ties with Iran less than a day after demonstrators in the Iranian capital stormed the Saudi embassy there to protest Riyadh's execution of 47 people, including prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, who was a frequent critic of the Saudi royal family. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells VOA all of this might be an overreaction.
Quite clearly, there have been problems between Saudi Arabia and Iran for quite some time. The point is that on neither side, neither of the two sides, there has been a measure of moderation or, for that matter, mechanism whereby they would be able to cool their tensions. Now, the consequence of that has been that both sides have been ramping up responses and reactions to each other. And now finally it's got to a stage where it could very well be a point of no return and will lead to greater degree of instability, in fact, a very fundamental instability in the region itself.
Demonstrations against the execution of al-Nimr have taken place not only in the region, but around the world. A 6.7 magnitude earthquake shook remote northeastern India before dawn today near the borders with Bangladesh and Myanmar. At least 4 people were killed, dozens of others injured by falling debris in the rush to get out of buildings. Quake was centered about 30 kilometers northwest of the city of Imphal, which is capital of Manipur state. Mauritian authorities, Mauritanian authorities, are searching for an Islamist militant who escaped from prison where he was awaiting execution for his part in the plot to assassinate the president, Mohamed Ould Abdel Aziz. This is VOA News. U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is dismissing his appearance on a recruitment video made by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. In the video, Mr. Trump is shown as a campaign rally at one last month reading a statement calling on the United States government to ban Muslims from entering the country. He defended his comments Sunday on the CBS News program Face the Nation.
The world is talking about what I've said, and now big parts of the world are saying Trump is really right, at least identifying what's going on, and we have to solve it.
Mr. Trump called for a ban on accepting Muslims in the U.S. in response to the deadly attack on a state government facility in San Bernardino, California last month, carried out by a Muslim husband and wife who investigators say had been radicalized. Unidentified militants attempted to storm the Indian consulate in the northern Afghan city of Mazar-e-Sharif on Sunday as gunfire and rocket-propelled grenades rocked the surrounding area. No group claimed immediate responsibility for the attack, which came just a day after a deadly assault by suspected Islamist militants on an Indian airbase near the Pakistan border that killed at least 7 troops and left 4 gunmen dead as well. VOA asked Australian National University scholar Raghbendra Jha if these are related attacks.
Yes, I would think so, because as you know, last week of 2015, there was considerable momentum towards normalization of relations between India and Pakistan and between Pakistan and Afghanistan as well. Now, this and India was playing a reasonably important role in both processes. Now, with these twin attacks, both those processes have been sought to be derailed, and one has to wait and see what will happen going forward.
These assaults come a week after Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited both Kabul and Islamabad, the first to visit Pakistan by an Indian leader in over a decade. Here in the United States, an armed militia group has seized control of a federal government facility in a remote area of the state of Oregon. The group broke into the headquarters of a wildlife refuge Saturday after staging a march in a nearby town to protest the imminent imprisonment of 2 local ranchers who were convicted of setting fires on federally owned land several years ago. Federal judge recently ruled that their jail terms were too short and ordered them back to prison to serve at least 4 extra years beginning today. Get more news by going to our website. You can find us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Monday, January 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Sudan opposition leader accepts an African Union invitation for talks with President Bashir's government.
This is not a change of position for my party, because my party have been all the time committed to radical change in Sudan to resolve all these crises and to get to peace and democratic transformation.
Mariam Al-Magdi is vice president of the Umar Party of Sudan. Liberia's main opposition party criticizes Vice President Boakai of violating the code of conduct for public officials. An Ebola survivor in Sierra Leone faces new hardships, and a former prime minister leads in early Central African Republic election results.
With roughly two-thirds of the votes counted in Bangui, the capital, Faustin Touadéra, former prime minister in the government of ousted President François Bozizé, leads with 31,000 votes.
That's VOA correspondent Katharina Hoyer in Bangui. Zimbabwe farmers say government farm aid might worsen hunger and black market vending in New York City. Those stories plus Marco Woman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan opposition leader Mariam Al-Magdi says her party will honor an invitation from the African Union to attend a meeting in Ethiopia with officials of the government of President Omar al-Bashir to discuss a national dialogue intended to solve the country's problems. A national dialogue launched last year by President Bashir has been going on. Mariam Al-Magdi, daughter of opposition leader Sadiq Al-Magdi, is the first woman vice president of the Umar Party. She has been critical of the current dialogue, saying the environment in which many Sudanese are in prison and newspapers are being confiscated is not conducive for any dialogue. Now she says an African Union-sponsored dialogue will discuss the root causes of the problems in Sudan.
This is not a change of position for my party, because my party have been all the time committed to radical change in Sudan to resolve all these crises and to get to peace and democratic transformation through dialogue and or popular uprising. And regarding the national dialogue, from the beginning we have been very much committed to the national dialogue through the resolution of the African Union Peace and Security Council Resolution number 456 of September 2014 and the most recent resolution number 539 of August 2015, which mandates the participation of all Sudanese stakeholders and to address all issues of Sudan together to reach peaceful peace, comprehensive and just peace, and democratic transformation, and that to prepare for by a preparatory meeting to take place outside of Sudan, specifically in the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, all partners to participate. So this what is happening now, we of course disregard the dialogue that the National Congress Party have been conducting inside Sudan.
So your party, you have been invited by the African Union, you are going to go to Addis Ababa?
Yes, to Addis Ababa. When the exact date is specified, we will be there, and we are already committed with other, with our colleagues, our position regarding this important meeting to get out to produce the rules and procedures of the national dialogue.
As you know, madam, the national dialogue has been going on. Are you not late?
No, this is not the national dialogue. Everybody knows this is not the national dialogue. This is a dialogue that has been hegemonized and orchestrated by the ruling party, the coup makers, who do not want any change and who are not addressing the root causes of the problems in Sudan. And also all armed movements and major opposition parties like ourselves, Umma Party, the Party of Independence of Sudan, and the Party of Plurality in all free and fair elections of Sudan, we boycotted this nonsensical dialogue because it's orchestrated by the national dialogue in Sudan, where there is total absence of basic freedom, the freedom of expression, freedom of organization, freedom of movement, and there is no rule of law. And it is headed by the ruling party, and dehumanized by the ruling party.
So a dialogue with the African Union involved, how would that be different from the one that is going on now?
Okay, yes, this is very important. It would be different because already the conditions stated in the African Union Resolution number 456, Article 14, specifically B, is what we are calling for, because it needs to have conducive atmosphere first, and with detailed items, the basic freedoms, the participation of everybody, the addressing of all issues. Number two, it would allow for its preparatory meeting to take place outside Sudan in Addis Ababa, and that would allow for the all stakeholders to participate in the preparation.
Mariam Al-Makdi is the daughter of opposition leader Sadiq Al-Makdi and also first woman vice president of the Umar Party of Sudan. She was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Liberia's main opposition party, the Congress for Democratic Change, the CDC, is accusing Vice President Joseph Boakai of violating a code of conduct which bars government officials from using government resources while engaging in political activities. Janga Kowu, National Secretary of the CDC, says the Vice President used government resources, including vehicles, while campaigning for the ruling Unity Party candidate in the December 29th Lofa County District 2 by-election.
As you may be aware, there was a by-election in Lofa County on the 29th of December. The Unity Party did field a candidate, and as you may also be aware, there has been the code of conduct for public officials that have recently passed by the national legislature, which in the certain provisions call for public officials not to use state resources to campaign for their own political ends. Contrary to these provisions, the vice president was in Lofa for 2 weeks using state resources to campaign for the candidate of the Unity Party. And that's a clear contravention of Section 5.1 of the Code of Conduct, as well as Section 9.6 of the Code of Conduct, as well as Section 8.1 of the Code of Conduct, which bars government officials from using government facilities and government properties for personal political activities.
The vice president is from Lofa County, and you are saying he used government resources. What specific government resources did he use?
This was a political campaign, right? In the political process, individuals do have the right to campaign. Government officials have the right to campaign. But when they are using official government resources and government facilities, such as vehicles and other things, and other government-assigned utilities, it's a clear violation of the code of conduct, which specifically bars government officials from using these facilities for their own political ends.
Janga Kowu is the National Secretary of the Opposition Congress for Democratic Change, CDC Party of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. A spokesman for Liberian Vice President Joseph Boakai says an opposition criticism that the vice president violated a code of conduct for public officials is baseless. George Saar, director of media relations for the office of Vice President Boakai, says there's no way that anyone can separate the office of the vice president from anything he does.
Is it possible to draw a line between the vice president and whatever he has to do? Are they saying that if the vice president should go to a Unity Party program, he should not ride or he should not drive a government vehicle, he should not carry security, he should not be entitled to all of those things that he's entitled to as vice president, he should strip himself of the presidential, vice presidential immunities and work there as an ordinary citizen?
Did the vice president campaign for this candidate in the Lofa by-election? Did the vice president campaign for the individual?
The vice president is the vice senator of the Unity Party. It's very clear. He's the vice senator of the Unity Party. And the vice president has been petitioned by the people of Lofa, who he has accepted to run for 2017 presidential election. Now, what they do not understand is that nobody in power can strip themselves of the offices they have as president or as vice president. You strip yourself of the security forces around you, you forget about the vehicles and get in a taxi to move to a local county for Christmas, because there is a campaign going on and then you have in president. I don't understand this.
George Saad is Director of Media Relations for the Office of Vice President Joseph Boakai of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Today's Monday, January 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Sierra Leone has been Ebola-free since November. The country is now trying to move forward into 2016. That is proven to be challenging for some. Nina De Vries has more from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The new year has set in, and Daddy Hassan Kamara is grateful to have his children with him. They mean the world to him. He is one of more than 4,000 Ebola survivors in Sierra Leone. Nine of his family members were not so lucky and died from the disease, including one son.
I'm really suffering. I'm really seeing things very, very hard.
Since his recovery, he has not been able to find work. He has eight children and two sisters to care for. He contracted Ebola from his mother in November of 2014, a time when the virus was surging across Sierra Leone.
When I was in the treatment center, I was totally mad over the whole thing because even when doctor called me to give me medicine, I always ignore, you know. Then there are times the doctors become feared about me. They fear me.
The Ebola virus, which is transmitted through direct contact with bodily fluids, also ravaged Guinea and Liberia. The initial outbreak started in December 2013. Over 11,000 people died during the crisis. Now Sierra Leone and Guinea have been officially declared Ebola-free by the World Health Organization. Liberia should be completely free of Ebola transmission by this month. It's clear that emotions and memories are still raw, though, for those who fought the virus as well. Sally Ojala was one of those people. He's a social mobilization officer with the UN Children's Fund UNICEF in Sierra Leone. He went door-to-door informing people on how to protect themselves from catching the disease. Jalo's happy 2016 was rung in Ebola-free, but worries about a reoccurrence. One of the biggest warnings against Ebola transmission is to avoid body contact, a difficult task for Sierra Leoneans, as the society is mainly affectionate.
Lack of hugging, handshaking. We do not want them to actually abandon these behaviors now. But there's very little you can do. You see people backslapping each other, hand shaking hands, and then dancing together. It's frightening.
As for Kamara, he worries about his future. He doesn't know how he'll pay his rent or continue to provide for his family. He's been getting help from friends, but knows that will not last forever. Still, he's trying to keep his spirits up that 2016 will bring him better luck. Nina De Vries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
First results have been announced in the Central African Republic's December 30 presidential and legislative elections. Two candidates, Faustin Touadéra and Anicet Dolokele, have enough support to advance to a second round of the presidential race. But ballot counting continues. Katerina Hoyer reports.
Yerikata Gaston Mandata, 1131.
With roughly two-thirds of the votes counted in Bangui, the capital, Faustin Touadéra, former prime minister in the government of ousted president François Bozizé, leads with 31,000 votes, just ahead of Anicet Dologele, also a former prime minister, with 28,000 votes. As the results were announced Saturday, Touadéra supporters, such as campaign staffer Rosalie Emmanuel, gathered outside a candidate's campaign headquarters.
Le premier tour, c'est du chaos. C'est un homme intègre.
The first round is for Touadéra. It's a knockout. Touadéra is a man with integrity. He's a unifier. The presidency is his. Results from the provinces and the diaspora are pending. Ballots from Central Africans voting in Morocco and neighboring Congo-Brazzaville arrived at the Electoral Commission Saturday. Votes from the provinces are expected in coming days. The head of an African Union observer mission, Suleiman Ndiaye, said the elections were peaceful and transparent and that observers did not notice any irregularities or any fraud in the sense that anyone opened ballot boxes and threw in extra ballots. In that sense, he said the elections were free and fair, but there were some logistical difficulties. Two-thirds of the polling stations the AU observers visited opened late. Some stations did not get any ballots for the legislative elections. Others ran out of ballots for the presidential election. Residents who had not received their voters' cards were allowed to cast ballots if they could present a valid ID card or a seat for the voter card. Elections have been postponed three times due to logistical difficulties. The Central African Republic has been rocked by violence since March 2013, when a largely Muslim alliance of rebel groups overthrew President Francois Bozize. The rebel leader left power in 2014, and sectarian violence between the anti-Balaka militia and Seleka rebels has continued, killing thousands and displacing nearly 1 million people. Katerina Hayat for VOA News, Bonn.
Farmers in Zimbabwe say they have been forced to sell the seeds and fertilizers supplied by the government for the 2015-2016 planting season to avert a current hunger crisis. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, diverting the farm supplies will have an effect beyond the agricultural industry.
At the height of Zimbabwe's farming season, the Sanyati farming area, some 250 kilometers southwest of Harare, normally would produce lots of cotton. It is an important income-earning multi-purpose crop spun into fabric for exports, while its seeds are processed into cooking oil for local use. However, for many farmers, that is no longer the case. 34-year-old farmer Titus Maposa says cotton prices have declined so much that it is unprofitable. He says that for years he has been growing cotton, but now he says it is causing hunger. He says he sold the fertilizer he received from the government for $20 a bag. Others actually sold it for $10 a bag. Others are putting it in their maize fields. We will not grow cotton, he says. After the government noticed a decline in cotton production in the Sanyati area for the past years and a rise in the number of people asking for food handouts, it began giving free insecticides, herbicides, seed and fertilizer to farmers. But farmer Mutewa Majasi says that will not work unless the government addresses falling cotton prices. He says the government must tell us first the price so that we can decide to take supplies or not. They might offer us a lower price than last season of 3 cents a kilogram. Now they might offer us 2 cents or 1 cent. It is not clear. It's help, but they are not being helpful. Majasi says farmers have no options and are being forced. He says the government might force them to sell at whatever price since it gave them seeds and fertilizers. So he says the government must first consult farmers on which crops they want to grow, whether be it maize or sorghum. A government official in the area who requested anonymity to speak freely concurs with the farmers. He says many farmers take whatever the government offers because it is the only way to get a bag of fertilizer. He says the farmers will take the cotton seed but not grow the crop and instead use the fertilizer for maize production. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
There are some 20,000 street vendors in New York City, and 90% of them are immigrants. Black market operations are the norm because there are too few permits to satisfy the marketplace. Those who support or oppose street vending agree on one thing: the system is broken. VOA's Bernard Schussman reports.
Mohammed Bargash and his wife Hoda bring their cooking to Lower Manhattan. The Egyptian-American couple have been feeding Wall Streeters for 17 years. He is licensed, but has to rent a permit by paying a percentage of his income to the permit holder.
It's too many people that apply for a permit, but they don't have enough for the same people they have their license. If you have like 10,000 people have license, they don't have 10,000 permits.
There's been no change in the number of street vending permits in 34 years. However, the immigrant population has changed, and many risk fines or spend thousands of dollars in the underground black market renting and selling permits. City Hall is hearing about it.
There's about a 15-year waiting list to get one properly from the city. You can end up paying $20,000 or $25,000 for that two-year permit, which the city grants for only $200.
Traditional businesses are not enamored by the street vendors, feeling some loss of revenue to cheap, fake merchandise and food they consider less than restaurant quality. Dan Pizark is with the 34th Street Partnership.
The people out there operating the carts are not the ones who have the license. They're hired hands. The people who have the licenses, who knows where they live? I don't know.
If you ask any of these protesters, they'll tell you there's an anti-immigration attitude towards street vendors. But one councilman supporting the vendors says New Yorkers are all immigrants.
There's not one New Yorker who is not an immigrant. Even if it's someone whose great-grandfather was a Jewish, Irish, Italian, or Afro-American who moved from the South, a new group of immigrants who came from Latin America, from the former Soviet Union, or from Africa, we are all immigrants in this city.
With it all, there's no shortage of people looking for work, and their first job is usually learning how to sell food or goods on the streets of New York. Bernard Schussman, VOA News, New York.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with handball. Defending champions Tunisia beat hosts Switzerland 37-29 to retain their Yellow Cup handball crown in Zurich, Switzerland on Sunday. Early on Saturday, they dismissed Austria 34-29 to advance to the final. Austria outplayed Portugal 34-30 in the bronze medal playoff. Tunisia used the event as a warm-up to the Africa Men's Handball Cup of Nations starting in Egypt in a fortnight. Turning to athletics, Waknesh Edessa prevailed in the women's contest in a lifetime best of 2 hours, 24 minutes and 4 seconds at the Xiamen International Marathon in China on Saturday. Runner-up Martha Lema and Fantu, a teacher, completed the Ethiopian women's medal podium sweep. Meanwhile, Kenyan Vincent Kipruto clocked 2 hours, 10 minutes and 18 seconds to triumph in the men's contest. Ethiopians Shura Kitata and Feyisa Bekele placed second and third respectively. In Spain, Kenyan-born Mike Keegan of Turkey clocked 27 minutes and 35 seconds to triumph in the end of the year San Silvestre 10-kilometer road race in Madrid, Spain. Lynette Masai of Kenya was a clear winner in the women's race in 31 minutes and 38 seconds. In Italy, Ethiopians Tamirat Tola and Netsanet Gudeta were crowned winners at the both classic New Year's road race in Bolzano, northern Italy. Tola won the men's 10-kilometer contest in 28 minutes and 28 seconds, while Gudetta prevailed in the women's 5-kilometer event in 15 minutes and 57 seconds. Finally, in golf, Nigerian Tokunbo Pedro placed third at the World Juniors Golf Series in St. Augustine, Florida State in the United States of America. He finished behind American Andrew Aligood and Germany's James Lombardo. The 54-hole contest featured players from 23 countries. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, January 4th.
Dear VOA, I wish to commend you for the great opportunity given us to express our views on your media throughout last year. And I wish you a very prosperous 2015. Please keep it up. I am Prince John Ushio from Bendi in Obanuku, Obudukatu Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. That's it for this Monday, January 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one.
Next on Reporters Roundtable.
Join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable. I'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the big events in Africa in the year 2015. So please join us on Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.